Celebrate our industry's best at the 2021 Stars of the Industry virtual event.
Join us as we, the NCF&B podcast, MC the NCRLA's Stars of the Industry next Tuesday, February 16th at 5:30 p.m.
North Carolina's hospitality industry is brimming with outstanding leaders who are raising the bar for excellence in performance, service, and commitment to the industry.
After this challenging year, it's more important than ever to honor and celebrate those who have persevered and made a difference in their community, their employees, their teammates, and the industry.
This year's event will take place live at the Angus Barn Pavilion
for award winners and presenters.
And given current pandemic capacity restrictions, the event will also be simulcast for attendees via Zoom.
So wear your most comfortable pajamas.
The event is free, however, registration is required.
To register, click on the link in our show notes
or our link in bio on Instagram.
Or go to ncrla.com for more information. The Stars of the Industry Awards, Tuesday, February 16th at 5:30 p.m.
Hope to see you there.
We better win the award for best live read promoting this event.
You are listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. Thank you for downloading and subscribing. Coming to you virtually live from high atop the historic Raleigh building in beautiful downtown Raleigh. The NCF&B takes the listener behind the scenes to tell the stories of the people that contribute to the creation of the food and beverage community of North Carolina. And now, the misfits in the dish pit, the faces of the front, they are Max Trujillo and Matthew Weiss.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss. And we are in the Ag Center right now, and we have the pleasure of speaking with Seth Church, one Seth Church of Apple Brandy Beef. Welcome, Seth.
Hey, guys.
How's
Great to be here.
Yeah, thank you for letting us come into your town. We're excited to be in Wilkesboro. It's a place we haven't really physically gone to or even explored, and shame on us because we've been in North Carolina now for, well, I've been here for 7 years, roughly, and Matt, what, four?
Four and a half,
yeah. So we're making our way around the state, but I think it's nice that even though we've been doing the show for 4 years, there's still new chapters of North Carolina to explore.
We should take a second, though, to thank the man who's responsible for us being here, who's sitting in the room, and Mr. Thomas Sally. You are head of the tourism board for Wilkesboro?
Tourism Development Authority, Wilkesboro, that's correct.
Nice. Yeah. Well, thanks for having us come out here. Like, this is really cool. What do you say when people say, where's Wilkesboro? Everybody has an eye, like a quick 5 second. How does that mean?
Yeah, for me, I would say we're a little over an hour north of Charlotte, and we're situated right between Winston-Salem and Boone.
And if you don't know, you're kind of the gateway to the Yadkin Valley.
Right.
Which is North Carolina wine country, if you're listening from outside of North Carolina.
I think they know.
Correct, they know, yes. Yeah. I hope you know. But, okay, so Seth, Apple Brandy Beef, what is it that sets you guys apart and makes you guys the business that you are today?
Oh, the quality. Mm-hmm. So we're a true Wilkes County product. The livestock we harvest are from our fourth generation family farm right here in Wilkes. We raise them, we finish them on corn. We now own the USDA processing facility in Wilkes, so we harvest them in our own plant. We distribute them ourselves to restaurants in western, central and western North Carolina and butcher shops. So our kind of our quality aspect of it, or our niche market, is that we dry age the whole carcasses. From 14 days up to 6 weeks at times, depending on the customer's needs.
Well, so yeah, it's not, you're doing the whole side.
We do the whole sides, yes.
Yeah.
And that helps for marbling and tenderness, is that right?
Tenderness and flavor, yeah. It intensifies that flavor, that dry aged, and the tenderness from the marbling,
if there is. And also, they are a cross between Angus and Hereford.
We do, ideally. We like to harvest. We feel like those give us the best carcasses. We get some benefits from both. So the marbling from the Angus and the yield from the Hereford.
Is that a typical practice for other cattle companies?
Well, commercial cattlemen in general, for generations, have identified the advantages to crossbreeding. So the Angus for them, the economic traits of any breed. But yes, the Angus and Hereford would be one of the most popular the cattle industry.
And you said generation. That was actually leading me to the first thing I was going to ask. You're no stranger, or even to your family, no stranger to doing what you do. You're fourth generation?
Fourth generation, yeah.
Wow.
North Carolina Century Farm accredited, so we're proud of that.
Century Farm. So you guys have been doing this since 1920? Or
beyond? Over 100 years. So wow. Yes, on the same land. So.
That's wild. And so recently you acquired the processing plant, too, just last year. That's
yes, May of 19.
Yeah, as the story goes, that you were Thomas's number one client. You were bringing your cattle for processing there more than anybody else, and he was retiring, and so you said, yeah, why not?
They had a great family business. Their family started in the late 60s, so it was, and they wanted somebody that would carry on the tradition and the quality of work, and so...
Sorry, when it comes to with the family, because that's now expanding your business into like another horizon too, because it's something that you hadn't done before. Did your pops look at you and go, "Wait, what are we doing? Like, was this your decision, or how did that come together?" Because that is kind of evolving your business into a processing facility as well as raising the cattle.
Yeah, it has, and the a little bit about our infrastructure, you know. When I got out of school, my parents had their farm, and kind of the apple brandy beef, the marketing part of it, the finishing the animals and direct marketing part of it was my deal to kind of give me a role in the family farm and grow it.
Yeah.
So when we moved on into this, they've been super supportive. When we started years ago, my mother would literally deliver meat to restaurants in coolers in the back of her car for me. I mean, because nice. I had a real job for a while before I could farm. So.
A real job. I love that.
I had a real job.
No, but that's a commonly used term in the food and beverage industry, which is an interesting thing. So many servers or bartenders all hire for a restaurant. They'll say, well, you know, I'll do this until I'm ready for my real job. I'm like, what's your real job? Because this job's probably going to pay you $60,000 this year. So I'd say if you're paying your bills, that's a real job. So, yeah, we take pride in the things that we do here, especially now more than ever. These jobs are few and far to come by.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, though, as far as... you know, the lore or lure of Wilkesboro, when you were going to school and being that you're the fourth generation, was there what brought you back what were you doing before you moved back or came to work for your family?
No, I grew up, and of course, I guess my childhood dream was to farm.
Okay.
My parents said, go get a real job. You're going to starve.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, this is not sustainable. So it was my goal. Went away to college, NC State Ag Business. But just with the mindset of I'm going to figure out a way to make this family farm sustainable, to be able to make a living at this.
Yeah.
So, and my idea was, let's finish these animals and provide a quality product that we can direct market.
That's cool.
That's refreshing. You don't hear that too often.
Right.
It's usually, I'm not going to do what my dad did.
Yeah.
I'm going to do my own thing. And then almost reluctantly, it's like, I just got pulled back to the farm.
My mother, she was in education. She was an elementary school administrator. But a teacher I had as a child told her, she tells this story. She says, the lady says, Seth will be the only farmer in Wilkes with a master's degree.
Yeah.
More my words.
So nice.
After 5 years at NC State, my mother said, you're welcome to stay, but you've got to pay for it.
Right.
So I didn't get a master's. I just got my degree and came home. But
yeah.
Well, that's still admirable. So you came back to Wilkesboro. And so what were some of the changes you made? Like, what you got to be in charge of the marketing, getting the name out there, and probably some of the processes. Like, maybe, Mom, this isn't the best way to deliver it from the back of your car. Let's fix that up. And then how long did it take you to actually get, like, the head of it?
Yeah, we started in 06. So I graduated in 04 from college. Started doing a few animals in 06 and marketing those out of the back of the car, literally. A couple years of that, and we got involved with a new whole animal butcher shop that was coming into the scene in Asheville. And at this time, Asheville, as it still is, now nationally recognized as a food city, it was really emerging, and it especially was in North Carolina, kind of the local food place to be. So we got involved there with a whole animal butcher shop, the Chop Shop Butchery. And when we, they helped propel us. That marketing and that name recognition that they gave us. They
Chop Shop Butchery.
Yes, Chop Shop Butchery. So we have a close relationship with them, now vested in them. So it's been huge for us. I mean, it has. I can't say enough about that, what that's done for us, is being there. And we've been their sole beef supplier since the concept of their butcher shop.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's an interesting relationship, and it's refreshing to hear that too, where, you know, if you're a farmer, and we've talked about this before, like with chefs that are related to the farmer in an agricultural sense, like in a vegetable sense, where, I think, who are we talking to? We're talking to Roberto Coppa from Coppa, mm-hmm. where his connection with his farmer, he'd say, you know, I think we want to, could you grow X or could you grow Y? And it's like, because I want to do snap peas when they come out there so that I can prepare this dish. But doing this with livestock, with cattle, like there's still a personal touch, like where the chefs or even like the focus of the cuisine might, you know, somehow influence the way you raise the cattle. And so, like, walk us through, like, maybe what that, those maybe decisions. Are you dialing in how you raise your cattle per your restaurant's needs?
Our goal is the quality, the highest marbling animals that give a good yield. Marbling is risk management for bad cooks. I mean, that's that's what we do.
You're covering it up.
Yeah, I mean, you know, even if they burn it, it's still going to be tender if it's well marbled enough.
Excuse my naivety here, but so, because I mentioned marbling earlier, and you're kind of like, yeah, well, marbling. So marbling's not necessarily what you want, is what you're saying.
It is. Okay. It is what I want. Okay. Yes. So the dry aging is a substitute for marbling if there's a lack of it.
I see.
So we give them both.
Okay.
We take a prime grade marbled animal, or what would be a prime grade if we had a USDA grader on site, and then we dry age it. So it's really through the roof with quality.
And marbling, just in a real remedial sense, is, what is it, the fat to meat?
Intramuscular fat.
Intramuscular fat.
So when you pick
fat,
up that nice steak, and it's those white lines of fat.
Mm-hmm. It's what my insides look like. A lot of intramuscular fat. I will be delicious someday. Someone.
Well, forever stuck in the Appalachian Mountains. And
hey, we're going to... Yeah, it's you and me this weekend, man. Right. If I don't make it...
I'll eat you.
I'll
go full cannibal.
So you have a perfectly marbled meat. So that... Okay, so the marbling, though, comes from, obviously, I would assume, the diet, the age...
Diet and genetics.
And genetics.
Yeah.
That's it.
So, yeah, we select genetics that... they've been measured to be superior marbling.
Yeah.
So with that genetic selection, we keep meticulous records on the farm of all the livestock, pedigrees, birth dates, benchmarks of weights and measurements throughout their life.
Do you find that, like, certain zodiac signs are better food? Like, don't get those Aries.
Well, I'm a Scorpio, so yeah. I'm kind of partial.
Partial Scorpios, yeah. Yeah, you're like, those Libras are so wishy-washy. I don't know if they're going to be good or not. Yeah.
Scorpios have the best intermuscular fat, for sure.
Yeah, no doubt. It was funny. We were, like, reading some of the stuff. Matt was reading aloud to me in the car. It was very adorable, just about a lot of the things that you do. The term finishing, it almost sounds like that's like you're sprinkling salt on something at the very end. But really, isn't it when the cow is like at a mature state and now it's just time to fatten them up before slaughter? Is that?
Yeah, just a short period before harvest when we put a little more energy in their diet and a little less forage or roughage.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So up until that point, they're eating mostly forage and roughage, and then they're just finished with corn is what you're
Correct,
saying.
Correct, yes.
Okay.
They're going to spend the majority of their life out on the lush green pastures of the foothills here in Wilkes.
Or yeah. Can you hear that, all you vegans? It's fine.
Yeah. So, I have a question about that, because there's a lot of people that are pushing back on corn-fed cows these days, or not these days, it's been for the last, whatever, mm-hmm. 10 years, and there's this big, you know, hot button or trendy term, grass-fed beef. So, but you seem pretty steadfast and sold on the fact that you want to finish them with corn. So what are some of the benefits and why? What are the reasons for that?
Well, the quality of the product, for one.
Yeah.
Two is, I feel like it is the most sustainable method of production. Mm-hmm. If we're going to, as a country, if we're going to feed the masses and we're going to feed our population, The corn-fed product is the way to do it. It's right. the most efficient. What we do is offer consumers a choice. Most local producers that market their products at farmers markets or your local restaurant are going to be grass-fed.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're going to be. We offer them that choice of getting a quality local product, but being corn-fed so they get the quality that they want.
Okay.
The quality they're used to getting.
Yeah.
The cows are happy.
Yeah.
They are. Cows are they're victims of evolution, just like humans and all species. So 1,000 years ago, they probably did thrive on grass alone or bushes or whatever they ate.
Yeah.
But with the genetics that we've selected to feed the population of the world, they can't do that on grass alone and be happy cows.
Hmm.
They need some energy in their diet.
Okay. Let me ask you this. What about the corn that you feed them with? Is that a locally, or can that be a locally?
Oh, it is. We grow a large portion of it right here on our farm. If we don't grow it, we buy it from local farmers in the area.
Okay, so corn does well in Wilkesboro.
Yes, it's a top corn producing state for cattle feed in the county in the state. Top producing county.
Well, there we go.
I love that. Okay. Well, and it's just as an end user, I mean, I will always say, like, it's really nice to say that everything's grass-fed, but if you've ever just eaten a steak that's 100% grass-fed compared to something that's finished with corn, you notice the difference. Like, in the end, Tom Colicchio said this one time in an article in Playboy, because I used to read it for the articles, but he was talking about how to make a perfect steak, a New York steak, and he said, first sentence was, real quick, we're going to put a lot of butter and a lot of salt on this. And he said, and if you're not about to do the things that I tell you to do, just stop reading this and go have yourself a salad. And I appreciate that, because if you're already going to be in the realm of having this steak, then let's get the right steak. Let's do it right. And I know there are some great 100% grass-fed farmers out there. There's Wolf's Creek, I believe, up there in Virginia. Like there's some guys that can do 100% grass-fed, and they do a great job, so I'm not saying that you cannot do it. But for the lion's share of the difference is it's that marbling factor, right?
Correct.
That is where that finishing with corn, or just changing the diet from the grass to a grain in some form, is really what allows it to just have that fattiness that really ultimately turns into the flavor that you're going to get out of the steak.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, in the end, I mean, heck, man, if that's why you're cooking, that's what you want. And I would challenge a lot of 100% grass-fed steaks to go up against. I mean, I'm certain you've probably done that in your time.
Well, I think you say, do you offer a choice? Like, are there some that are solely, have you ever?
No, we do not. But yeah. Consumers go around for local foods in North Carolina, the majority of the local beef is going to be grass-fed that they're provided.
So yeah.
When we came onto the scene, we gave them a choice for a corn-fed product that was local.
Yeah.
So I'm always still fascinated about the processing, too, just because when you say processing, that's like breaking the cattle down, and you're not doing just cattle. You also do pork, and you have ostrich, right?
Yes.
And you're doing, I was going to say, what separates
those
you?
Boots? Yeah. Is that what you're pointing out? Yeah. Well,
just talk to us about those boots for a second. I think that's ostrich leather. Is that right?
Correct. That's a shoe envy right now.
I have pythons at home, but that, you know, it's not the same.
I had to change that cow shit on my other one, so I left them outside.
These are your fancy boots.
Yeah,
right? This is like a podcast boot.
I was coming in here in the office. I thought I should change.
Imagined up too.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Are there ostriches on your farm as well?
No.
Or that's from another?
Yeah. So it's part of our processing at the abattoir. We do custom work for other local meat handlers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and we do some ostrich for people in North Carolina.
And because we're in North Carolina, at least from what we saw on the site, pork still reigns king as far as the production, right?
Like, yeah.
You're still processing more pigs than anything else.
We do a lot of pigs, and the majority of them are local.
Yeah.
I mean, still, the people that still have their backyard pig they raise to feed their family. And Loopers in Granite Falls, a top-notch family operation, multi-generational.
Yeah.
We pigs from them we harvest. For barbecue restaurants in the area, for butcher shops, same as we do our beef.
That's awesome. So do you break down into primes as well? Like, are you butchering down, or is that something that then you give to a butcher?
Both. So we have butchers on staff, so we break it down into primals for food service.
Primals, yeah, sorry.
Yes. And then we also have some butcher shops that will take whole sides.
Yeah. primal is the traditional. You've got like the ribeye, the T-bone, and you know the fillets and all that. So that's like the standard cuts. Are there odd requests from restaurants that you get that are like, oh, you want this, or you want it processed a certain way?
Yeah, we get a lot of interesting requests, but our goal is to utilize every part of the animal.
Yeah.
From the oxtail to the tongue, the cheek, the traditional cuts, as you mentioned.
Yeah.
So we work with independent restaurants, no chains really for what we do. Hmm. And we have developed a relationship, especially with these that we've been with a long time, that they say, hey, this spring we're thinking about changing our menu. Does this work in your product mix? Because of the 10 animals we harvest for apple brandy beef every week and process, not every restaurant is going to get skirt steak or bavette or cheek or those cuts that there's only a few pounds of. So,
but you're more of a kind of boutique in the sense that like that's what you have. I mean, that's what's
we've
available.
We've got to develop that relationship to work a phone call away with the chefs of all these restaurants so we can get that product mix to work right. I mean,
I
have to imagine though that like, so I know beef cheeks is a popular thing and amongst the chefs said it's a delicacy, but like, you know, it's not like everybody on a restaurant is saying, yeah, let me get the beef cheeks or, you know, but you're able to sell all of that and the other, you know, let's say, less popular cuts?
Yeah, it's seasonal. I'm not going to say at certain times of the year we don't have to put a few items in the warehouse.
Okay.
And currently we're in Christmas season, so rib roast and tenderloins are in high demand. Mm-hmm. I would like for somebody to start a tradition of eating meatloaf for Christmas so I could get rid of some ground beef. That would be great.
Well, I'm Jewish. We like meatloaf for Hanukkah. There you go. So, you know, we could do that.
Oh, yeah. It's day two of Hanukkah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We talk about barbecue all the time this year. It's been the year of barbecue, especially with most restaurants not being open. The barbecue restaurants seem to have been doing okay. Brisket comes up all the time. We've been talking brisket. My kids asked me the other day, and I feel like such a moron. They were like, what part of the cow is the brisket, Dad? And I was like, it's right there in the middle, I think. So let me ask a guy that actually knows. What is the brisket? And two questions. Well, follow-up question inside. Brisket alone by itself tends to not really be like a high choice cut, but then through the processing of what a badass pitmaster can do, ends up being kind of like the best thing you could ever have on a cow. So that wasn't really a question, it was more of a statement. Where is the brisket on a cow?
The brisket, between the front legs.
Between the front legs?
And yes, between the front legs starting up to the neck. So
okay.
It's, you know, got a lot of fat on it.
Yeah.
But with in the last few years, with people, or this year especially, people at home barbecuing, they bought a green egg or whatever fancy brand grill.
Yeah.
With high demand.
Right? I mean, like that?
Yeah. Yes. Well, everyone wants to be able to make their own. But it is like the hardest thing to make because from what every pit master or home barbecue chef that I've talked to that ever does brisket right, for whatever reason, you have to do it overnight.
Time-consuming.
Like, yeah, time-consuming. You literally have, it's like 12 to 16-hour cook to really get it right.
And a whole case of beer.
Exactly.
Just gotta sit out there.
One of my Y Guide's dad buddies, he gave this crazy tip, and I was like, man, you got a lot of dedication to do this. But he took a brisket, he seasoned it like crazy, he threw it in his smoker for a few hours, then he took it out, he vacuum-sealed it, and threw it into an immersion circulator and sous-vide it overnight. And then took it out, rested it in his refrigerator for another night, and then proceeded to slow cook it on a grill for the actual event. I'm like, dude.
That's a huge investment.
That's a big investment.
Yeah. I was like, and sadly, I wasn't even there to experience it. He was just telling me all of this, what he did. But I like that method. I like kind of like, you know, multi-cook methods and all. I would have to think, as a fourth generation cattleman with the family, you guys must do some cookouts at home. You must know how to cook your beef.
Oh, I'm a horrible cook.
Really?
Well, my mom is the best.
Okay, well, so someone in the family was doing it. Okay, that's good. Okay, and then obviously the most pertinent question, where do we get your beef?
Mm-hmm.
How do we get it? Who's distributing it?
Or somebody listening now is a chef in, say, Raleigh or Charlotte, and they want to get it. How do they get it?
If you're a chef and you're in a city in North Carolina wanting our beef, find us on social media, reach out to us, and we will be in touch. We will get you the product. We'll get you samples, and we will get you the product. If you're local and you want to come by in Wilkes, We have a small retail shop at our abattoir. We're under expansion. We're going to open a larger retail shop in downtown North Wilkesboro, hopefully open by the spring, to have fresh cut meats available.
What's your Instagram, or how do we?
It's Apple Brandy Beef, hashtag Apple Brandy Beef, I think.
Oh, cool. So, yeah. At Apple Brandy Beef. So you're not part of a larger distributor. You don't sell. You sell direct to customer.
We sell direct to customer. We've got our own delivery truck, delivery guy that delivers every day.
That is awesome.
Yes, it's cut fresh. The ground beef we deliver to restaurants is ground that morning before it goes on the truck. Same day delivery.
Well, there you go. The epitome of local.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for your time. This is awesome. I can't wait. We're going to have to go find some restaurants that sell this and mow it down.
I'm about ready for a T-bone right now. Seth, thank you so much for all you out there. Go get yourself some apple brandy beef and you will eat very merrily.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
All right, everyone. We're going to take a quick little break to hear a word from our sponsors. And then we're going to speak to Tony, the owner of Amalfi's of Wilkes, a fantastic, authentic Italian restaurant in the city of Wilkesboro. I'm talking about Triangle Wine Company, purveyors of fine wine and craft beer. The Triangle Wine Company offers local delivery, in-store pickup, curbside service, wine shipping, and keg rental. With locations in Morrisville, Cary, Holly Springs, Southern Pines, and soon to be Raleigh, they are here to service the community for all of your beverage needs. And be sure to use the NCFB promo code to receive a nice discount when placing your orders. Visit TriangleWineCo.com or call them at 1-800-919-7518. This episode is also brought to you by Boss Coffee USA, Japan's number one coffee brand, coming to you here in North Carolina, and technically all over the Americas, because it's available on Amazon.com. Coming in three flavors, black, vanilla, and cafe au lait, Boss Coffee is flash brewed, which means it's brewed hot and then chilled fast for optimal flavor. Make sure that when you are purchasing your Boss Coffee on Amazon, you use our promo code, which is NCFBPODCAST. You will receive 10% off your purchase because we like you a lot. So thank you for listening. Thank you for enjoying Boss Coffee. And now back to the show.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss. And we continue our voyage through Wilkes County, just outside of downtown Wilkesboro. We are at Amalfi's with Tony Cosaiola. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
So we just walked in, and we also have Thomas Sally here as our, you're effectively our tour guide in a sense.
Yeah, that's right.
Showing us around the whole place. You made it a point to say, we got to go to Amalfi's, because this is important. From your perspective, why? What's so great about this guy?
Well, first of all, people love him. I'll say that. I've worked with Tony now for over 10 years, and anytime his name comes up, it's like, oh, we love Tony. There's just an opportunity to celebrate Italian food in the mountains of North Carolina. And, you know, Tony is great about sourcing and just preparing fresh foods. And he's always creative and thinking about different types of ways to prepare food and, you know, just a great chef. So,
and to paint the picture, so we're inside of Amalfi's before you open. And what is this, maybe a 50 seat? Restaurant?
It is. It is. Originally it was 84, but you know, because of the COVID and whatever that comes with the 50% capacity, so we took them out a few tables.
Interesting.
Just to make sure that everybody's safe, 6 feet apart. And
so it's called Amalfi's.
Yes.
Is the food supposed to be super specific of the Amalfi Coast or?
Well, I mean, it would be nice.
Okay.
It would be really nice to do something like that. It's just then the food around the Amalfi Coast, it's 100% around the seafood.
Yeah.
And we don't really have the capacity to get all the fresh seafood that we want from sea urchin to conch and other things. Mm. It's very hard to get it. And plus, here they're more about lasagna, Alfredo sauce.
Yeah.
So we kind of make our customer happy, and we do our specialty things like octopus, stuffed mussels on the side. That's a special.
Yeah.
Yeah. We witnessed you put a massive octopus in a pot. An 8 pound octopus in a pot just now. And going back to Regan Stockler, a former guest of the show, he's a chef. We were talking to him about there's only two ways to cook octopus, really quick or really long. There's no middle ground. If you're going to do it quickly, a ceviche style, or you have to cook it to get all the muscle tissues to kind of soften. So what is your process? What are you doing with that?
My process, it's slow cooking because I want to tender as much as I can be. And then I'm going to add some potatoes in it. And then we cool off everything. And it's kind of like you're eating a potato salad. But instead of mayonnaise, we put olive oil. We put a little bit of celery, olives, carrots. And you're eating like a cold salad.
Yeah, oh, okay. It's like a chilled octopus. That's
chilled octopus, yeah. And so how long will it be? And so you break it down after you bring it out of the
pot? It's going to be cooking in that pot for at least an hour and a half.
Okay.
Then I'll let it cool off, cut them up, mix all the rest of the ingredient, and put it in the refrigerator. When it comes up, lemon juice, a little bit of parsley, fresh garlic, mix everything, ready to go.
Nice.
Yes.
Okay, how did somebody like you, and you told us just before we got on that you were raised in Italy, but you're originally Greek.
No, my last name, I did a research on Ancestry.com.
Okay.
Because my grandmother, grandfather, he was one of the workers on the World Trade Center in New York.
Oh.
But we never heard from him ever since. So he came over here back in the days, you know, once you will come across, it was impossible to go back because it was 1 month at the sea, it was hard and money and all that. So we never heard from there. And my grandmother, she always tell me stories. So I went on ancestors.com and I researched a little bit my family trees.
Yeah.
And it brought me to Greece.
Okay.
So.
But you didn't know that before, recently.
No, okay. I don't know that. I don't know that at all. Because I mean, my last name, where I'm from, is a common last name.
Okay.
But just in the little town where I'm from,
which is
Bacoli. It's it's in Naples. It's a little town at the sea, Campi Flegrei. Okay. So we do have a lot of history there, and a lot of it they come from Greece.
Okay.
It was one of the biggest way to communicate between Greece and Naples. They used to stop to my town. And we have a lot of ruins. No longer ago, in this downtown in the city, we find underground, we find two Greek vessels, then used to bring things over, you know, back and
trade,
forth.
Whatever.
Exactly. It was a trade. Exactly.
Spices, the right oils. Word.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I did the research, and that's what it came down to. Then,
cool.
Somewhere.
And how did you get to Wilkes County?
Well, I've been in North Carolina for the last 24 years.
Okay.
And I choose North Carolina because it gave me the impression a little bit as Italy, as the four seasons. We got the mountain, we got the sea, we got a little bit everything that I have back home. And that's why I choose North Carolina. I was in New York, but I was there for a week, and then honestly, I ran away. It was too busy for me.
Yeah.
I just...
you wanted a little quiet.
It is.
So like 24, 25 years ago, you immigrated from Italy to the United States.
Yes, sir.
And you started in New York.
I stayed there 1 week, and I left.
But what was your game plan? I mean,
did you come to cook in a restaurant?
You're a young guy, so you were probably a kid when you came over here, right?
I was 20 years old.
Okay. Oh, so you're a lot older than I
was. I was 20 years old, yes. I finished my Navy time.
We're the same age,
I was in the Navy in Italy, the Italian Navy, and then when I got out, I was like, I need to do something. But I always liked the United States. For somehow, since I was 5 or 6 years old, I always wanted to come over here and leave a mark, leave a signature somewhere. I was like, I need to go. So, 20 years old, I was like, it's time.
Heck yeah.
I came without a... without the education of the language, I don't speak no English at all.
Yeah.
And I had $25 in my pocket, but I made it through.
And by yourself?
Yes.
Yeah, like maybe with some, you came over with the military, but...
I just came over here by myself. I had a connection to start in a restaurant, and that's it.
Did you have any culinary background before you started working in a restaurant?
I worked in a restaurant business since I was 13 years old.
Okay.
That's what I always done. I don't know nothing else other than this.
That's what you do.
No,
which is an interesting aspect people talk about right now with the crazy industry and everything shutting down. It's like, well, just try something, do something else. It's like, most of us don't know how to do anything else. This is what we do.
No, well, I mean, when you have a family, I guess you're going to do anything, but
yeah, you have to
this is
out,
my job.
This
is
my job.
I got a question. What were the meals like in the Italian Navy? So were you guys like cooking octopus on the boat and pasta every day? And
I was very fortunate, Thomas, because I was stationed on a small island right in the middle in the Mediterranean Sea, close to Sardinia Island. And it was only 134 people on the island. And on the other side, we used to work with the Americans. I used to work with a destroyer called the Salmon Lake. There were 3,000 people on that destroyer. And so we worked with them, and we got a chance then, you know, at nighttime from the pier, cooking, catching fresh calamari, bringing in, cooking. I mean, it was fresh.
Yeah.
Wow. That's naval culinary excellence right there.
Yes.
Then you go pick up the wine from Sardinia, right? And you're doing well.
Yes. Yes.
That's pretty awesome. So I'm still curious, though. I want to link it up. How did you're in New York, you're cooking at a friend's or contact's restaurant, and you're like, this is not for me.
Uh-huh.
And then so somebody said, oh, we should go check out North Carolina, or you just go
no,
to North Carolina?
I had a guy here in North Carolina.
Oh, that you knew somebody.
Yes, that I was talking to, and he was like, well, I mean, if you want to move down here, it's a little bit more quiet, not too expensive, you can give it a try. So I came, and I was in Eden, North Carolina.
Okay.
Yeah. I started in Eden. From Eden, I moved to Greensboro.
Okay.
The Triad, Greensboro, Winston-Salem, mm-hmm. and High Point. And then about 11 years ago, me and my wife, we were taking a ride up in the mountains, and I saw the restaurant, Amalfi. I was like, let's stop by there. So I met the guy, the owner, we were talking, and all of a sudden he was like, you know, this place is for sale. I was like, okay, so let's talk about it.
Yeah, and you were just driving through the
mountains. That's it, yes, yeah. And I've been here ever since.
Oh, wow. Was he an Italian guy?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
In that time when you were working in Greensboro, you were working in restaurants already?
Yes. So,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, I have a question for you. And mm-hmm. this is, when you cook here, you're an Italian guy, you're from Naples. Growing up in Naples, you have very specific cuisine.
Yes.
But, and this happens a lot in America, that it's Italian-American food, right? Like you said, you have to make the lasagna and the chicken parmesan and the spaghetti meatballs, but it's like, does that ever frustrate you in saying, yeah, but I want to cook the food that I know? Yeah.
A lot, of course. For a lot of different reasons, because I like what I do.
Yeah.
So, it's hard to do things than we don't have it in Italy, things than maybe it's not called the same way.
Yeah.
And for much than I like, you know, the Italian American culture, but sometimes they destroy
what is really Italian.
centuries of history, because it's not just about the Romans' history, right. It's also about food. You know, we have the pizza margherita as a history behind it. We have the carbonara, same thing, as a history behind it. So when you see the carbonara made with the Alfredo sauce,
yeah,
it is a frustrating.
Yeah,
it is. Mm. But right now, that's where people know.
Right.
So it's up to us to let understand that that's wrong.
Yeah.
And so this is the real thing. So you're pushing it, you're giving it a try, I put it on special.
Yeah.
And now I have people, can I have a carbonara without Alfredo?
Yeah.
Can I have the pesto without the creamy?
Yeah.
Or can I have a shrimpy lemon sauce instead of calling shrimp scampi? Because in Italy we have shrimps and we have a scampi.
Mm-hmm.
It's two different
preparation.
You know, exactly. Two different preparation. They're similar, the shrimps and the scampi, but they're different in the taste.
Yeah.
But if you go to Italy, you ask somebody, can I have a shrimp scampi? They don't understand that you want a shrimpy lemon sauce. They're going to ask you, what do you want, the shrimp or the scampi?
Yeah.
So
it's similar to, like, David Chang mentions this in Ugly Delicious about Chinese food, and that he's like, American Chinese food is not Chinese food in China. It's no one eats that type of stuff, and it's a completely different culture of food. But
as a business owner here, you're like, I've got to make a lasagna because I need to keep the lights on. Oh. People are, Americans want to eat the food that they think is Italian and whatever it is. I mean, and that American crafted Italian food is delicious. There mm-hmm. It's good food. It's comfort food, you know, it's probably not the food that you were raised on.
No. Yes. It's different. But I mean, it's so not that it is bad. It's just then I want to make sure then people understand. I have the opportunity to bring my tradition somewhere else.
Yeah.
The way I embrace this tradition, this culture, I want people that when they're eating my food, they be like, okay, this is the real thing. That's the way it's going to be done. So same thing, for example, I do, it's in a very old recipe. It's stuffed mussels. When I was a kid, my father, he used to bring home mussels from Genova and Chioggia, which is northern Italy.
Yeah.
But those mussels, they are huge. They are, I would say, about 8 or 9 inches long.
Oh, wow.
And so, yes, my mother, she used to open it and stuff it with the ground beef, peas, calamari, and then cook in a ragu sauce. I came across the New Zealand mussels.
Yeah, the green.
The green lip. And the big one.
Yeah.
So I started to do the same.
Okay.
And it was very unexpected, but I have a huge turnout on those mussels. I can't keep up making it.
Oh, really?
So wow. That's what it is. Sometimes you do the traditional thing, the simple and easy thing, and it worked more than all these
complex dish
and signature and yeah. sauce and all that. So
that's great to hear.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit more about your menu. What I love, I actually love hearing a chef's perspective of their menu as opposed to the guest. Walk us down. Like, what are you preparing? How does your menu structure?
The menu is from 2008 to now. It changed a lot. Before on the menu, it was a lot of fried mushroom, fried zucchini, fried this, fried that.
Yeah.
And so honestly, I changing from the appetizers to main entrees and to salad, I want more healthy food. So my menu changed in a way. Yes, I have the most traditional things that people like it, like mussels marinara. I do the calamari, but it is a variation. You know, if you want the calamari cooking in a sauce with olives and capers, I will do that.
Yeah.
If you want the mussels in the butter and the garlic, yes, I'll do it. But otherwise, I like with my cherry tomato, fresh basil, and a little bit of garlic.
Yeah.
And homemade crostini. So things like that. My menu, it's respect the whatever it is today, the Italian-American food.
Mm-hmm.
I have to do it because here, that's the way they used to it. And but in the same time, I'm trying to put a little swing where people can try that way or my way.
Yeah.
And so a little bit of time, I'm trying to bring these people on the other side of the boat.
Yeah.
You're balancing.
Exactly. And maybe in next year or so, because 2020, let's not talk about it, but...
Oh, is something wrong?
No, everything's good.
Yeah.
But next year, maybe I will change the menu and have an even more traditional than what it is.
Cool.
I'll try to bring in the buffalo mozzarella from Italy.
Mm.
Even though we have a company here now in Charlotte that does here from scratch.
We were just talking about that.
Siani cheese.
Yeah, we just mentioned it. We spoke to a gentleman that makes a Neapolitan style pizza in Cary.
Exactly.
And we're going to have to tell.
Only will bring the buffalo mozzarella in.
This is my next step. Bring the brick oven in.
Yeah.
Get rid of what I have. And using the Siani cheese. Which is the real...
Have you tried the Charlotte cheese? Have you tried their...
Oh, all the time. I'm a customer.
Oh, nice.
I have a brick oven at home, so I need to have my buffalo mozzarella.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yes.
So, okay, when you... let's talk about you just bought this place from another mm-hmm. another owner. He was also Italian as well.
Yes.
When did this place originally open? Because
in 2002.
In 2002. And then you took over in 2008?
Yes, 2008.
So, did you... What was it like then? And did you make significant changes to the menu? Or, like, how did that...
Oh, I mean...
How'd that work?
Oh yes, this place is being changed completely from any perspective, any ways. This place, I mean, here on one side there was upper, there were steps and dangerous steps, then people keep on falling, get in the kitchen. So I changed everything,
yeah,
from the menu to the structure, everything, from 2008.
Yeah.
After 6 months, I changed the menu once I took over in 2008. And right there, I saw an increase of, I would say, at least 30-35%.
Oh, wow.
Yes, because, I mean, people, they were ready to try something new. People, right, they are ready. Don't get me wrong. I mean, people here like the challenge. Mm-hmm. You know, they like to try. They try. They like to try new things. They like it fine. They don't like it. It's okay. At least I tried. That's the mentality. So I'm fortunate to, you know, work in a community like this, because, yeah, at least I have the opportunity to let somebody try what I'm talking about.
Yeah. And Thomas made a point of putting this. Is this your house-made pesto?
Yes, where I have my brick oven, I have an herb garden.
Okay.
And I grew from rosemary to turmeric, oregano, Greek, and American. I grew so many herbs. And in September, before the cold gets in, I cut everything and I make my homemade pesto.
Now, do you put pine nuts in your pesto?
No.
Is that?
Because this is not the real Genovese pesto. This pesto is made with Thai basil, rosemary, turmeric, thyme, sage. So it's completely different. With this one, you can cook it, you can marinate your steak, you can just spread on a piece of bread and eat it.
Interesting. Oh, so you did your own riff on it.
Exactly. Nice.
You chefed it up.
Mm-hmm.
When you buy the pesto, the money...
Oh, yes. Well, I mean, because I was in the Navy, and I really am thankful for, you know, the men and women serve this country all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
So 20% of this pesto, it goes to the veterans.
Oh, wow.
Awesome.
Yes.
That's cool.
It is.
That's fantastic. So how's the business going? You're
I'm can't complain. I gotta be honest with you.
Yeah.
The virus, it is what it is. The ordinance are what they are, but we stay strong. We, of course, we need to modify a few things. I brought everything out from the back, the cash register.
Mm-hmm.
I open a window where is the fence out there, so I do drive-through.
I was going to say, like, was the kitchen, it was probably not set up like that before. You have, like, an open window to the kitchen.
Exactly.
But you changed it into, like, a cash register to
exactly.
where you could walk up and order from
exactly.
directly.
Exactly.
That's cool. You made a pivot, as they are calling it.
Got to.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But business, I mean, I do like the fact that, like, in any town, like, you go into, you know, this is a small town for all intents and purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But to have the ability to have some diversity of flavor and all is I've talked about this before. That's like in Raleigh or in the Triangle. Sometimes, like, culture of restaurants is void because there's a lot of different ethnicities all around, but they're not here. They didn't come here to build restaurants. They came here for other purposes, like tech or finance or whatever it might be.
Yes.
So no one's like opening up a restaurant from their hometown.
Yes.
So it's really nice when you do get an expression from somebody that is literally from the country that the other food they're making.
Which, yes.
It's
yes.
nice to tie that into a community.
I think that Tony does a wonderful job with, you know, like you said earlier, you can try it this way or you can try it his way, and the way that he's able to, you know, you build up your trust, you come in, you have a great meal, then Tony says, hey, try this, hey, try that, and before you know it, you're a full-blown Neapolitan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
We'll be trying. I mean, that's because I like what I'm doing. It's not for the money.
Yeah.
It's because that's what I know how to do it. Like I said, I've never done anything different. I tried working in construction. I hurt myself a couple of times. I was like, that's it. I'm done.
But it's nice being your own boss, right?
Yes.
You're in your own place. You're in charge.
It is nice and hard.
Yeah,
that's for sure. A lot of headache,
yeah.
A lot of things to keep up with.
Oh sure,
but it is nice.
Yeah.
Yep.
What about, like, are you making the pastas fresh daily and the?
For the business, the volume business that we have.
Yeah.
It's impossible for me
okay.
unless I work 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
So I do my homemade pasta. I make my fresh pasta on special.
Okay.
I did a rainbow triangle ravioli not long ago. I did the big tortellini. I do with the calamari squid ink spaghetti,
Squid ink
linguine. that I serve with my seafood. But this, like I said, those things are special.
Do you have a recommended who supplies your pastas?
I work with a company called Cisco and the other one called Atlantis.
Okay.
Which they brought me all my pasta. It's the Checo pasta and the Vella pasta.
Okay.
I get all my pasta that's imported from Italy. I like it not because it comes from Italy, because it really, it keeps the temperature, it stays al dente compared to different pasta, I would say like a Barilla. Barilla doesn't keep the al dente.
Mm-hmm.
Barilla, you cook it,
it's mushy,
and you gotta eat it, because if you don't eat it, it continue cooking.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difference in the pasta. Then that's why I want that one, the Divella or the Checo, because if I cook an al dente, you're gonna eat it after 15 minutes, it stays al dente.
Right.
So
I think it's interesting that, for at least this is my impression, but in Italian food, that the pasta is the meal and the sauce is kind of like almost like the dressing, you know, that Italians emphasize more the pasta. And like you talked about, the conditions of the pasta, as opposed to us as Americans would say, well, the sauce, blah, 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 and the pasta is just sort of like
the vessel.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I just think that's fascinating.
A good pasta, I mean, it's a good pasta.
Yeah, exactly. And when you have a good pasta, you know it right away.
Of course, yes. I wish we can bring me in pasta from Gragnano. Gragnano is close to the Vesuvio Mountains, and the entire city is involved in a pasta. That's the only thing they do.
Mm.
So if you go somewhere and you see Garofalo Gragnano, it is, I would say, number one in the world.
Garofalo Gragnano.
Yeah, it's the best pasta.
Okay.
Yep.
Cool.
Well, thank you for this time.
Yeah,
man.
This has been great.
No problem.
We are looking forward to taste some of your beautiful dishes over here. So, and
I'm going to go cooking before.
Yeah, you got to get back there. Make sure the pasta's holding its temperature.
Yeah, it's about to jump out.
It's jumping out right now. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Tony. For those of you that are in Wilkesboro, come to Amalfi's, you will eat and drink very merrily.
And before we get out of here, I want to speak to you about Proof Alcohol Ice Cream. That's right, think differently about your dessert, because now in a new year, they brought back an old favorite. I'm talking about their bourbon chocolate cherry ice cream. First released last year, they brought it back again for the second time because it's so delicious. Made daily in Columbia, South Carolina, look for the red pints and coolers at Lowe's Foods, Total Wine, Harris Teeter, and of course, Triangle Wine Company. Find out more information, go to proofalcoholicecream.com or visit any of their 200 retail locations across the Carolinas and Florida.
Thanks for listening to the NCF&B podcast. And if you've stuck with us this long, review us on iTunes and remember, 5 stars are encouraged.